drape your faces in ancient paste, and dance to the pipes of Robert Redford. He stands in the hallway, crying, over an immersive play he just attended on his Oculus Rift. Will you console him? You droopy fashionos. What's the crack? God bless. How are you getting on? Welcome to the Blind Boy Podcast. Number 28. Holy fuck. Do you notice anything different this week? Huh? Something about the sound? You may not, but I fucking do. The echo is gone. We are back at peak podcast hug. We have maximum fidelity. Because I am recording from my brand new studio. It is a dry room. And the reason that the fidelity this week is fucking class is because of an act of soundness from one of the listeners. A very generous act of gas country. As you know, you've been listening the past couple of weeks, I've moved into a new studio and the sound for the past while hasn't been completely up to scratch. We've had two issues. There was an echo in the room. This echo is now gone. Listen. Olang Johnson. Hello. Olang Johnson. There's no echo. This room is as dry as a bishop's shin. Because bishops don't have sweat glands. When a bishop becomes a bishop, God confiscates their sweat glands. Gives them back to him when they die. But this room is fucking dry. And that's what I want. And the reason it's so dry is because two incredibly sound listeners, two gas cunts, Fiacra and Etna, who run Avenue Road Studios up in Portobello in Dublin, got onto me on Twitter and they said, we listen to the fucking podcast, we've been hearing what you're saying about the sound of your room, it sounds very lively. We build studios, we'll come down and fit your fucking room with some acoustic panelling. And they did. They called down. Lovely people. And they brought some. Fiacra makes these acoustic panels himself out of rock wool. Rock wool is it's like asbestos that won't kill you. So what he did, and it was brilliant to see. The two of them came down and they had a mirror. I'm like, what the fuck are you doing with a mirror? But they sat down at my desk and they used the mirror to plot where the sound was travelling in the room. And then based on this reflection, they placed panels all around. And there's even a panel above my head. And Fiacra, God bless his soul, he even screwed the grate onto my wall. There was a, what do you call those things in the wall where it goes into the outside? A ventilation grate. I didn't have a cover for it. I just had it stuffed full of Dunn's bags. And it was making the room very humid. But Fiacra used his drilling ability to put a cover on the fucking vent. Which technically has nothing to do with sound. That was just me kind of taking advantage and getting him to do DIY. But anyway. And he also stuck four. I've got a lot of guitars, you know. And I've got fucking, how many guitars have I got? I've got an acoustic, two electric guitars, a bass guitar, a banjo, and a lap steel. And these things take up a lot of space. So I bought these kind of hooks that you stick onto the wall and you hang guitars off them, which, you know, free up a lot of space on the ground. So he drilled those into the wall as well. So a very, very big thank you to Fiacra and Etna from Avenue Road Studios. And what I'm going to do now is I'm going to plug the fuck out of them for their soundness. Avenue Road Studios is, it's up in Portobello in Dublin. It's about 5 minutes from the Bernard Shaw pub. And it's a rehearsal space that the two of them built themselves. And they have a few different rooms. They've got a drum kit, guitar amps, a PA, vocal mixer, the whole shebang, what you want. Tea and coffee is free. And you can rent rehearsal spaces. If you're a band up in Dublin or whatever you want to do, even if you want to write some fucking tunes, go to avenueroadstudios.com and call into Fiacra and Aetna and use their business, please, because they're, again, small Irish business just doing their thing. Support them, and they're sound enough to come down to me and fit my studio with fucking panels and listen to the sound of my voice. It's fucking lovely. And I have a panel above my head. It feels like Star Trek. I have a panel fucking drilled to the ceiling. It's fantastic. So thank you very much to the lads. So now that they did stick the fucking panels around the room, I got thinking. I was looking at Blade Runner. As you know, I absolutely adore the film Blade Runner. Mainly, what I love about Blade Runner mainly is its visual and aural aesthetic. The storyline is fucking incredible, obviously. It's very existentialist. It calls into questions about, you know, what is a human. But what keeps me going back to Blade Runner over and over again, because I watch it at least once a month, and I listen to the soundtrack to Blade Runner once a week, if not every day. The Blade Runner soundtrack is one of the soundtracks I listen to when I'm writing. Composed by Vangelis, who was a Greek. I think he's the only Greek musician I listen to. But the visual aesthetic of fucking Blade Runner is just gorgeous. I love it. Especially Harrison Ford's apartment. And the setting that was used for Harrison Ford's apartment is a building in Los Angeles designed by the famous architect Frank Lloyd Wright, called the Ennis House. And it has nothing to do with Ennis in County Clare, unfortunately. It was built because the man who owned the house, was his second name was Ennis. But anyway, Frank Lloyd Wright built this mansion, kind of inspired by Mayan architecture, Mayan and Aztec architecture. So if you look at Harrison Ford's apartment in Blade Runner, the walls have all these kind of Aztec panels. And I found a fucking company online, based in Sweden, I think, who make acoustic sound panels based on the Ennis Frank Lloyd Wright design. So I got onto them. I gave them a mail. I'm trying to see if I can order some of these fucking panels that are the same panels in Harrison Ford's apartment in Blade Runner, and any available space in my studio, I'm fucking covering the place in Blade Runner panels. And I'm putting lights all over the room, and I'm going to have this studio looking exactly like Harrison Ford's apartment in Blade Runner. I'm going to do it in time for October 2019, which is when the events of Blade Runner happen. And I'm going to wear a trench coat and drink Johnny Walker whiskey and wonder whether or not I am a human or an android. That's what I'm going to do with myself. That's what I'm going to do with my life. If you're a first time listener to the Blind Boy podcast, please go back to the very start. Just do, because like I'm after going fucking 8 minutes there now talking shite, and regular listeners are okay with this, but if you just started, do you know what I mean, you're just going to go, what the fuck is this? Go back to the start, please. God bless. One of the things that I said about this podcast a few near the start was when I was asking you to contribute to the Patreon. One of the reasons that I wanted the Patreon is to reinvest some of the money that you give me into creating, into turning this video from an audio experience into also a visual one, to try and, the ultimate goal is to do the full Joe Rogan, whereby the podcast is available as a video as well. That's the ultimate goal. I don't know how far away I am from that, but I have been working on creating a space which visually replicates what I consider to be the podcast hug. The podcast hug, of course, is, you'll hear that soft jazz piano in the background, the fidelity of my voice, the bass frequencies. I want to, you know, podcasts for me are a relaxing space where, you know, we throw on a podcast and it takes us away from the visual and aural cacophony of our daily social media lives, and you get an hour of mindful contemplation where someone else's voice inhabits the busyness of your own head. That's what podcasts do. And that's what I try and do with this podcast. So I want to do that visually. So I'm working on a space at the moment, a corner, which the aesthetics that I'm building, it's half Blade Runner, half David Cronenberg's Naked Lunch, and with a lot of otter related paraphernalia. I have my eye on an otter fountain, okay? It's this sculpture of some jocular otters just getting on with their lives, doing otter things. And it's about 4 or 5 foot tall with LED lights, and it has the most beautiful sound of trickling water. So I'm going to get my hands on that, dressing up the space, and then I don't know when, hopefully in the next couple of months, we're going to be dealing with a visual podcast hug where I can produce video content. I wanted to look, do you know like when a fucking, like if Donald Trump does a talk into the camera, he's got like a fireplace behind him or shit like that, or Vladimir Putin, or even Michael D. Higgins, any politician. I want it to look like that, except it's half Blade Runner, half Naked Lunch, and very heavily spiced with otter sculptures. That's what I want to do with my life. And thank you so much to everybody for supporting me in that. I love you very much. I'm talking awful fast this week, I just noticed, because I had a cup of coffee before I did the pot. I have a little bit of it left, actually. I've got a small bit of coffee left, but then a boiling hot cup of tea also. So I'm just going to take one sip out of the coffee, which I shouldn't, because it's making me talk quick. And then I'll calm down from here on in. But in a bizarre kind of feat of Jungian synchronicity, this is the second time that the audio fidelity of this podcast has been indirectly caused by the Irish singer Hozier, who I know listens to this podcast. How are you getting on, Andy? Give me a shout sometime. I'd love to have you as a guest. But yeah, Fiacre, who fitted out this studio, he actually played drums on Hozier's track Take Me to Church. And then another time, a couple of months back, I can't remember his name, and I'm so sorry that I can't remember your name. I even went through my Twitter DMs to try and find you. But one of Hozier's buddies had a microphone which belonged to Hozier. It was a little condenser microphone that you put into an iPhone for when I wanted to do podcasts on the fly if I was travelling. So one of Hozier's buddies sent me down this brilliant condenser microphone for iPhone. So that's twice that Hozier has indirectly contributed to the fidelity of my studio. So thank you, everybody. What am I going to talk about this week? Last week we spoke mostly about dogs, and last week's podcast was, I know, I was kind of sad a little bit, wasn't it? Because I was talking about the how dogs are bred for human pleasure and labour. And then I went into a World War III rant. But at the end, I reminded you to embrace the beautiful summer weather, and I hope you did. I was down at Yorty Ahern's couch there on Saturday, and it was fucking gorgeous. This weekend, in Limerick anyway, it was the first weekend of summer 2018, as far as I'm concerned. It was fucking beautiful, gorgeous and warm. The type of warmth whereby it comes down off of the sky but bounces off the tarmac, come up and meet your chin. Do you know that type of warmth? This week, sound. That let's talk about sound. Because I started off ranting about sound. And how sound can be used, maybe, not for pleasure, but for pain. There was a thing I was reading about called Operation Wandering Soul, which was a very bizarre CIA, what would you call it, CIA psychological warfare, right? The CIA are nasty fuckers. Millions, billions, billions and billions of dollars are spent on their nastiness. And during the Cold War, psychological warfare was a pretty big component of how the CIA fought their war. Now, I spoke about this before. I was talking about how the CIA quite openly fund films, movies, as part of the ideological state apparatus to influence the people of America or the people of the world towards a neoconservative view. I spoke about how the CIA funded American abstract expressionist painting as a way to move the cultural centre of the world away from Europe and towards New York. But Operation Wandering Soul, very fucked up. So during the Vietnam War, right? If you don't know what the Vietnam War was, it was part of the Cold War theatre of conflict in which the Yanks and the Russians, two nuclear superpowers, they never had any direct conflict. So what they did is they fought proxy wars. The Russians and Americans would never clash heads themselves. What they'd do is two conflicting ideologies of democratic capitalism versus communism. So with Vietnam, you had Vietnam wanting to become communist and funded by the Russians, and then the Yanks going, fuck that, that's not happening. So the Yanks fought the Viet Cong, who were a guerrilla communist organization. How they operated wouldn't have been too far. They would have been quite similar to the old IRA in Ireland, in that they were made mostly of poor farmers who used subterfuge and guerrilla warfare to fight a very well-equipped imperial power. And so what Operation Wandering Soul was a CIA-funded audio warfare. So if you think of your average Viet Cong soldier, right, or volunteer or whatever you want to call them, they were fucking dirt poor farmers with no education, living in the hills of fucking jungles with guns, right? Never seen a television in their lives, never seen a fucking radio, nothing. So there's this, within Vietnamese culture, they believe that the dead, that their dead have to be buried in their home village, right? Burying the dead correctly is very important in Vietnamese culture. And if the dead are not buried correctly, or if the body is never found, they believe that the soul will forever wander aimlessly in pain and suffering. Kind of like, purgatory. Or not even purgatory, like, do you know at Halloween we have jack-o'-lanterns, the pumpkin thingy. That comes from an old Irish pagan thing. I'd know what you call it, Irish paganism or Irish Catholicism, or how the two things intersect. But the Irish believe, culturally, or the ancient Irish believe, that there was a fella, or was it the Irish Americans? I'm not sure. There was a fella anyway called Jack O'Lantern, I think. And he had to wander hell or purgatory, and it was dark. So he carved a turnip and put a candle in it. And in America, this turned into a pumpkin because there was no turnip. So that's where jack-o'-lanterns come from. Anyway, I digress. The Vietnamese have a similar belief that if the dead are not buried correctly, your relatives will wander forever screaming and howling into the night. So anyway, what the CIA did is that when the big problem that the US forces had against the Viet Cong is that you couldn't see the enemy. They had a massive network of tunnels that dug into the ground where they would kind of go underground. The Viet Cong would go underground in these tunnels, come out of these spider hatches and hit the Yanks very quickly and sharply from the jungle. So the Yanks don't know where the gunfire is coming from. They just hear a lot of shots, a couple of soldiers are dead, and then the Yanks are just aimlessly firing into the jungle, and the lads are gone. They're gone back underground. Hit and run attacks, guerrilla attacks, which is what, you know, what are you going to do if you're fighting a well-equipped army? That's all they had. They used the environment to their advantage. So the Yanks were getting pissed off with this. One thing the Yanks did to fight this was the use of a defoliant called Agent Orange. In helicopters, they sprayed miles and miles and miles of Vietnamese jungle with this weed killer called Agent Orange. And it got rid of all the leaves, so it meant that the Viet Cong had nowhere to hide. Now, one of the problems with Agent Orange is it would drive US soldiers psychotic. It had a psychotic property to this weed killer. So a lot of US soldiers went back to the US, not only psychotic, but their chemical psychosis being rooted in the trauma of war. So there were quite a few Vietnam vets getting some powerfully disturbing visions because of Agent Orange. So another thing that the US did was Operation Wandering Soul. They recorded Vietnamese prisoners crying and screaming, and then placed speakers hidden in the jungle. So when the Viet Cong soldiers were on their patrols, and like I said, these are people who didn't have an education or unfamiliar with technology, they're walking around the forest at night with their belief that improperly buried dead are forever wandering the forest too, and all they're hearing are screams. And the things that the recordings were like, go back, you will die, really chilling stuff. So all the Viet Cong soldiers just put their fucking guns down and ran, because they've no context for what's going on. They just hear these speakers and think that they are the souls of the dead. I'll play for you now a little clip of some of the Operation Wandering Soul shit that was played out of the speakers. And the quality isn't great, but just imagine like being in the forest at night time in the pitch dark, not even knowing what a radio is, and hearing this all around you. Highly fucking disturbing, I think you'll agree. So that was Operation Wandering Soul by the CIA, going straight to number one there. But yeah, that's what they were doing. But it still kind of goes on today, the psychological operations in Guantanamo Bay, you know, on the war on terror. They were using audio to interrogate prisoners that they believed to be members of Al-Qaeda. And one thing the CIA were using was the music of Westlife. True story. When they were interrogating prisoners, they would play them mainly heavy metal. Very, very loud heavy metal, non-stop, 24 hours a day for weeks on end. To the point that the prisoner couldn't sleep, couldn't do it, like deafening, non-stop. And what it does is that kind of, it frazzles the brain a bit, you know. It creates an intense anxiety and a desire to break free of it and have some peace. But for every, we'd say 100 hours of dark, heavy metal that was being played, the CIA would intersperse it with a softer, more melodic song, and they chose Westlife. So they would play some Westlife for the prisoner, and what this did is, when it's kind of dropped on the prisoner arbitrarily, it creates a false sense of security, which can be very damaging, because it stops the brain getting used to the cacophony of the heavy metal by giving this completely random glimpse of hope, and then the metal starts again, so the brain resets. And there's a group of ex-Guantanamo prisoners who are now suing the psychologists who assisted the CIA in developing these techniques of audio torture. Another kind of freaky sound thing that's used in warfare. Now, it's not psychological warfare in that it's not designed to disturb anybody, but there's these things called number stations from the Cold War, and they're just weird and chilling. Nobody's fully sure what number stations are, and they certainly weren't during the Cold War. There's a type of radio called shortwave radio, and the only thing I can describe it as, it's the deep web of radio. It's like military radio, aviation radio, some emergency broadcasts. So during the Cold War, before the fucking internet, 50s, 60s, 70s, some people would have, you know, a shortwave radio at home themselves, and they'd be radio enthusiasts, geeks, I suppose, nerds. And why the reason someone, a civilian, would have a shortwave radio is that you might end up communicating with somebody halfway around the world, and, you know, that's before the internet, that's a lot of crack. So people would scan through the shortwave frequencies, hoping that they might find another human voice on the other end and have a chat or whatever, before the internet. But what would happen throughout the 60s, 70s and 80s is that occasionally people would land on a shortwave radio frequency that would just have very weird either sounds or a repeating robotic human voice. And there was conspiracy theories. People thought that they were hearing the sounds of ghosts or aliens. And these frequencies that were coming out of most countries were known as numbers stations. And I'll play you an example now of what a numbers station sounded like. Now they're pretty fucking chilling. And like, imagine being in you know, out your back garden or in your shed, fucking around with your shortwave radio, and you come across that out of nowhere, and you've no fucking internet to look it up. There's nothing about it in the library, and you've just found this frequency of a weird robotic voice or melodies over and over, never ending, just repeating the same thing over and over. And some of these stations would go on for months and then completely disappear and then come back a couple of years later. And that would have been quite fucking terrifying, you know? And it really baffled shortwave radio enthusiasts as to what the fuck are these things, you know? And like I said, naturally, they start to think kind of supernatural. Now, we do know now, like since the Cold War has ended, what they more than likely were kind of codes or instructions for spies that were situated either on the Russian side or on the Western side, situated in countries. And if a spy was in a country and needed a code that was meant just for them, they would find the shortwave radio and tune into the number station and then decipher whatever information was being sent to them. I've no idea why it had to be so fucking freaky. No idea whatsoever, but there's some number stations still run today. Now, even though that audio is terrifying, me as somebody who adores audio, I think they're quite beautiful. They're bizarre and strange. And when I first heard about them, it was when I would have been a teenager and I was first arsing around the internet, finding myself in different holes. And I heard about number stations and I couldn't hear. I'd read an article about it. And the internet was at the stage at the time where I couldn't actually hear any number stations because I think I was on dial-up connection. So I managed to source a CD called The Connet Project. And it was a CD, three CDs, where somebody had collected several number stations from around the world and put them onto a CD collection. And I had that when I was a teenager and I was fascinated with these things which I didn't know an awful lot about. And the mystery of them is kind of they're not as fun now that I know that what they were, which is just pretty boring messages for spies that we'll never understand what they meant, just numbers, repeating numbers over and over again. And I suppose they were so freaky because just the nature of shortwave radio, it's just a shitty quality of radio. And it's not a psychological operation as such, you know, but it is if you stumble across it by accident because it would scare the shit out of you. But there's other mad stuff. Magicians have been used in warfare quite a bit as a form of psychological operation. The first major use of magicians in warfare was by the French, by Napoleon III, who was Emperor Napoleon's nephew, I believe. French lad. There was a legendary French magician called Albert Robert Houdin. And the name sounds kind of familiar because Harry Houdini, the famous magician, was so obsessed with this French lad from the 1850s that Houdini named himself after Albert Robert Houdin. And Houdin invented a lot of the kind of parlor tricks and sleight of hand and modern illusionary magic. But anyway, the French are colonial pricks, like the British and the Spanish and the Yanks, a very colonial people. And the French had control of Algeria in North Africa under Napoleon III. And the French were fierce worried about a revolution and an uprising in Algeria. And they didn't want a war. They didn't have the money for a war in 1856. So Napoleon III, clever boy, thought of a fucking clever idea. There was a tribe a religious tribe called the Marabouts in Algeria, and they were gaining a fierce amount of support with the locals. And Napoleon feared that these Marabouts would lead the revolution that would free Algeria from French control. So Napoleon gets on to Albert Robert Houdin. And Houdin goes down to Algeria and meets with some of the tribes and the elders and all of this, and puts on kind of, I don't know, a town hall show, you'd call it, but it was probably in a tent in the desert in Algeria. So what Houdin did is he invited the strongest member of the Marabout tribe to the stage. So this is a man of huge standing and respect in his tribe and community, somebody that they all look up to as being a powerful warrior. So on stage, Houdin has this wooden box. It's a heavy wooden box now, very heavy. Not, you know, you'd want to be pretty fucking strong to be lifting it. So he invites up the head of the tribe, the strong man, and says, lift up that box. So the Algerian strong man lifts up the box over his head. The crowd go mad. They start cheering and clapping because here is their warrior exhibiting his strength, and they feel dead proud. So then Houdin says to him, with a wave of this wand, I'm going to sap all of your strength from your body. And of course everybody laughs. And the strong man goes, all right, go on, so. Giggling. So Houdin does, waves his wand over the body of this Algerian strongman, this tribal leader. What the tribal leader doesn't know is inside the wooden box is a very strong magnet that's connected to the floor. So essentially what Houdin did is that he then turns on this very strong magnet, waves the wand over your man's muscles and says the words, behold, now you are weaker than a woman. Try to lift the box. So the strong man tries. And the box that he was able to lift a couple of minutes ago, he can no longer lift because the magnet has it stuck to the floor. But of course, these fucking Algerians haven't a clue because they're not an advanced, technologically advanced civilization like the French. So your man is pulling and pulling. And it's not a joke anymore now. He's freaking the fuck out because he can't lift up this box and he can't understand it. And he starts screaming and roaring, freaked out, and runs out of the theater, absolutely fucking terrified. And then everybody in the theater, they're just after seeing their tribal elder have his strength sapped from his body. So they fucking freak out. They're going, who is this fresh French cunt? What special powers have these French bastards have that they can do this? We're not fucking with these lads. So then afterwards, to solidify it, Houdin again meets up with some tribal elders. He hands one of the lads a rifle. And in the rifle is a blank bullet. Of course, the lads don't know what a blank is. Houdin stands in front of the gun. He says to the elder, shoot me into the face. The elder is like, I'm not doing it. No, I don't want to shoot you. He goes, promise you, shoot me into the fucking face. So the elder cocks the gun, pulls the trigger. Big, massive bang, smoke. No bullet leaves the chamber, of course. And Houdin opens his mouth and appears to have caught the bullet in his teeth. One of the oldest tricks in the book. Of course, Houdin invented it. At this point, the Algerians are just like, this guy's a fucking lunatic. We cannot take on the French. Not a fucking hope. He's after sapping the strength of your man. He can do that to all of us. We'd be fucked. And they can catch bullets in their teeth. Forget about it. The revolution is called off. And through that psychological warfare, the French managed to hold on to Algeria for a long time. And eventually the Algerians got independence. I think it was the 1940s or 50s. They had to buy their independence off France. And as far as I know, they're still paying off the debt. France didn't even give it back to them. They were like, I think they did have a war. There was the civil war. There was the French Algerian war, where that's why there's a lot of Algerians in France today. But Algeria, yeah, they had to buy back their independence. Millions and millions and millions, and they're still paying it off, as far as I know, if they haven't recently paid off the debt. Because the French are cunts. Colonial boys. Nasty fuckers. So we've reached the halfway point of the podcast now, and usually what we do is we have our ocarina pause, which is where the app Acast inserts a digital advert into this podcast, which you may or may not hear depending on your geographic location. And what I do is I play an ocarina, which is a Spanish clay whistle. Now, for the past few weeks, I have not had my ocarina. So I played coins. I played with my flick knife last week. And then before that, I tapped a sherry glass to create a kind of a digital Angelus for the people who are not hearing the advert. You'll be very pleased to know that I have located the ocarina. I have it in my possession. So we're going to head back to our regular ocarina pause. I'm just thinking in the context of number stations. I wonder what if someone just stumbles across this podcast at just the point with the ocarina pause, and it's a little bit like a modern numbers station. So here is your ocarina pause.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
That was slightly longer than usual because I missed it. Because I missed that ocarina and I really wanted to play it for you. So if you're lucky you heard that, if you're unlucky, you were sold some bullshit. Okay? You were sold some shit. Oh yes. My book, The Gospel According to Blind By, it completely sold out about 2 months ago. We didn't expect the book to sell as well as it did, but it completely sold out, and the book company did not print enough to meet sales. So for the past about 2 months, people have not been able to buy this book, and it's been fucking sold online at stupid prices, which I was annoyed about, because there's nothing I can fucking do about that, you know what I mean? There's people who've ordered it on Amazon, it's not being delivered, all of this. I'm pleased to report that the paperback of The Gospel According to Blind By should be in shops today, the reprint. I was told it'd be happening today. So go into your local bookshop and there it is, available. Now, another thing I found out is when it was announced that it was being reprinted, so many bookshops bought it up that now they think it's going to sell out again really quick. So another reprint has been ordered. So the market will be flooded with my book of short stories. It's nice and weird and dark. If you go back to the earlier podcasts, you'll hear some of the short stories that are read out. This podcast started off as merely an advertising exercise for me to try and sell the fucking book. And I'd no intentions of this podcast being 38 episodes long. Thought it was going to be 3 or 4. Didn't think people would be interested in listening to me talk out of my hoop every week. But I guess you are. So next week's podcast is not going to come out on Wednesday morning. It's going to come out on Monday, right? And there's a reason for this slight disruption. Today, I went up to Dublin and I interviewed the actor Cillian Murphy for the podcast, okay? And the reason Cillian is coming on the podcast is because to speak about Repeal the Eighth, all right? I'm very concerned about men not voting in the upcoming referendum. And Cillian Murphy is concerned about the exact same thing. So we speak about why we feel men should be registering to vote, why we feel men should be voting to repeal the Eighth Amendment, why it is not just a woman's issue, why it's an issue that affects society. So tune into that next week on Monday. It's going to be out on Monday because I want it out as early as possible so we can get lads registering. Because the deadline for registration is the 8th of May. And double check that you're actually registered, because a few people get kind of stricken off arbitrarily, you know. And if you're thinking, fuck's sake, I'm not interested in that. We also talk a little bit about Peaky Blinders and whatever as well. But we're just trying to use our platforms. And he's got a much, much bigger platform than mine, you know. So you've got that to look forward to next week. Also, we recorded some short video segments about repeal, and these will be online in the next couple of days. You'll see them on social media, but the full interview is going to be on this podcast next Monday. And thank you to Yvonne McGuinness and Michelle Darmody for making the interview possible. I can't wait for it to go out. Is there anything else that I would like to talk about? Do you know, I was going to talk about, and I'll leave that for another. No, I'll talk about this. What are we, 45 minutes? I'll talk about this for a bit, because it's something I came across on the internet. And it has nothing to do with sound, but I'm trying to figure out the unifying theme of this week's podcast, you know. It's been kind of weird, it's been strange, you know, fucking psychological operations and just kind of weird stuff. So in the theme of weird stuff, but it has nothing to do with psychological operations, it's a very rare style of natural disaster. And there's only 2 known recordings of it in kind of modern history. I'll tell you what, we'll see what you think of this. In 1986, in the northwest of Cameroon, 1,746 people and 3,500 animals, livestock, just dropped dead. Okay? Dropped fucking dead. People came across the scene, and an entire town was just everybody on the ground dead. No kind of evidence as to what had happened. People, you know, dying in their sleep. Almost like Pompeii, but no lava, no smoke, no fire, no visible trauma on the bodies, save for kind of, some people had blistering on their skins and things like that. So no one knew what it's a little town beside Lake Nyas in Cameroon, and it was baffling people. It was scaring the fuck out of people, going, what the fuck happened? What happened? So what it was is it's a very, very rare natural disaster where a body of water is kind of trapping carbon dioxide in the bottom of the lake, you know, and all of this carbon dioxide can get released at once. So what happened to the poor people in Lake Nyos is because of some people think that it might have been either an earthquake or volcanic activity, a shit ton of carbon dioxide gas released itself from this lake. Now, this is invisible. First off as well, like 70% of the air that we breathe is carbon dioxide, but this was pure carbon dioxide, no oxygen. So this invisible, gigantic cloud of carbon dioxide slowly creeped down a mountain at night time and suffocated 2,000 people and a lot of livestock. And it's only ever happened twice in modern history. The Lake Nyos disaster. How fucking mad is that? So we're 50 minutes into the podcast now, which means that I answer a few questions that you ask. But before we do that, I'll get to the part where I ask for your support. This podcast is funded by you, the listener, through the Patreon page, patreon.com/theblindbuypodcast. If you like the podcast, if you're enjoying it, if it's providing you with a weekly podcast hug, and, you know, you can listen to it for free if you want, I don't mind, but if you're like, do you know what, Blind Buy, I like that so much, I would buy you 1 pint a month for your 5 hours of monthly content. If you're feeling so inclined, please go to the Patreon page, patreon.com/theblindbuypodcast, and donate me the price of a pint a month or a coffee. Because it makes a huge difference to my life. It gives me independence as an artist. I don't have to be fucking pandering to fucking television companies, pitching bullshit that I don't want to do. And I love doing this podcast. I like the fact that we just had an hour there of talking about interesting shit. Do you know, I couldn't do that on television. Not a hope. Some prick would be in. You know, some cunt would be, oh, I like the bit about the numbers and the numbers project, but do you think you can talk about Brian McFadden? Actually, do you know what? I did, actually. Yeah, I mentioned Westlife. Yeah, and then they would have said, can you mention Westlife, but don't talk about how the CIA used them for torture. Say something good about Westlife. That's what would happen if this was on television. And then I'd have to provide balance to the shit that I'm saying. No hot takes, there'd have to be balance. So I quite like this podcast and the complete and utter creative control. And I'm answerable to nobody other than you. And you're free to make suggestions and all of that, and I take them on board. And we do this as a collaborative journey. So if you like that, and you fancy giving me a few quid every month, please do, go to Patreon. If you don't and you can't afford it, that's grand, you can listen for free. I'm appealing to your soundness. Alright, let's get on to the questions, you bastards. Oh, I went a full podcast without someone texting me, and I got a text from a cunt. Okay, Anthony. Oh, we've got a live one here. Anthony's got a question, which I'm going to try and tackle, and it looks like a toughie. Blind Buy, there has been an awful lot of talk on the fragility and toxic nature of masculinity. This is leading to the marginalization of the young white male who cannot express their viewpoint for fear of being branded chauvinistic. Can you comment on toxic radical feminism, which is a lot more socially acceptable than the equally as disgusting toxic radical chauvinism, or how damaging enforced gender quotas in the public service can be? I think we have a different viewpoint of what toxic masculinity is, Anthony. For me, first off, masculinity itself isn't necessarily toxic. What I'm talking about is gender stereotypes, right? That are unhelpful, that lead to poor mental health. So for me, I would say how I was raised to be toxic in a masculine sense is that I was very much raised as a man to not speak about my emotions, right? That's one. Definitely. Suck it up. Be strong. You're a lad. If you have a gripe with somebody, hit him a slap. Certainly don't show weakness. Do not profess to the other lads that you might be in love with a girl because she's only an object that's to be fucked. Don't show vulnerability. All of these things, how I was raised, that's an ideal of masculinity that is not helpful to my mental health. That doesn't mean that, like, masculinity itself is toxic. I mean, I'm not sure what fucking masculinity is, to be sure, to be honest, but not expressing emotions, that's toxic as fuck, do you know? And it's an unhelpful stereotype of my gender, and I don't want to live up to that. It doesn't help my life, so I'm working hard to discard that. Can you comment on toxic radical feminism? I'm not sure what that means. Certain people who profess to be feminists also happen to be assholes, but that doesn't mean that the asshole represents feminism. It's like within any group, anything, whether it be feminism or railway enthusiasts, 10% of any group of people are going to be loud and obnoxious, and often the detractors will highlight and elevate the voices of people who are essentially just being assholes, and then these people represent the entire movement. So I don't look at, if I see, I don't know, if I see somebody online who's like those YouTube videos, radical feminist goes nuts, I don't look at those people and go, oh, feminism. I go, look at that person being an asshole or possibly suffering from mental health issues and in pain and expressing that as anger. But I don't look at that as encapsulating all of feminism, in the same way that if I see a man expressing what I perceive to be toxic masculinity, I don't consider him to represent all of the gender of men. Do you know? Toxic femininity, like, I've never heard that phrase, but there are certainly gender stereotypes, and, like, first of all, this is incredibly, that's difficult for me to answer, because I don't understand the female experience. I don't know what it's like to live that, because I'm a cisgender man, so I don't know. I can speak with experience about toxic masculinity, but regarding the situation for women, I'm just an observer. But there are certainly, if we take the word toxic to mean that it is toxic for the individual and those around them, there are certain expectations on the female gender which are not helpful for women, such as having the pressure to look a certain way, the definition of female beauty being purely physical and a certain way, ignoring the reality that people just simply have different body shapes, and that is the reality. There is no ideal. Everyone has different fucking body shapes. It's that simple. But women, more so than men, are raised to believe that one type of body is the perfect one. And we see that toxically expressed in the massive levels of body dysmorphia and eating disorders in females. I was raised as a man to believe that I must provide for a woman. And if I do not provide for this woman, I am a failure as a man. That is a toxic viewpoint for me. That is a toxic ideal. It becomes increasingly unrealistic in our current economic climate for me to be able to do that. Women are similarly raised to believe, don't go out and get your own stuff. Don't be the best that you can be. Find a man and let him provide for you. That's toxic. That's not very good for a woman's mental health to have that. And it certainly doesn't help how she progresses in the world. I spoke before about, you know, from a young age, little boys are raised to believe that anger, acting out anger, either verbally or physically, is an appropriate and rewardable response to a stressful situation. Young girls are raised to believe that verbal anger or physical anger or assertiveness is a bad thing for a young girl to express. However, tears are an appropriate response to a stressful situation, and sometimes not only appropriate, but that crying is the only response appropriate for a young girl in a stressful situation. So you end up with, you know, if you raise a little girl like that, you end up with a woman who deals with stress through tears. You know, anger is expressed as tears, not expressed as being angry. And then the world calls her irrational. That's toxic. Do you know? That's of no benefit to the person. These are, toxicity are about gender stereotypes and unrealistic gender stereotypes. And for us to live up to these things, it will cause us a continual cycle of pain because they are ideals that cannot be reached. But one thing I will say, they tend to be created by a male patriarchal structure of power. Okay? That tends to be what creates the issues with both genders in terms of unrealistic stereotypes. If people disagree with that, you know, send me a DM. Send me a DM and educate me otherwise, please. Because I'm open to fucking criticism. I'm open to change. That's how I see it right now. And if someone disagrees with it and wants to change my mind, I'll change my mind around that if I receive new information, you know. But that's the best way I can answer the question. And regarding gender quotas, I don't see a problem with gender quotas. I don't see a problem with inclusiveness in the workplace around race. I just don't see a problem with that. And another thing too, a reason I think that toxic masculinity specifically gets as much attention as it does is because at the farthest end of the spectrum, it expresses itself quite destructively and violently. At the far end of the toxic masculinity spectrum, you get sexual violence. You can't say the same for women, you know. You do get maybe toxic femininity expressing itself inwards as, like I mentioned, body dysmorphia. And you do get that too with men, with toxic masculinity is most certainly responsible for some male suicide. But generally, male toxic masculinity, it can be quite destructive and disruptive for society, you know, and that's why it gets a lot of attention. Keith asks, oh Jesus Christ, they're fucking tough questions this week. I just wanted to do a podcast on bad sounds. Alright, Keith asks, have you ever experienced irrational xenophobic fear on your travels? Is it just me or is it normal? And if it is normal, why do you think it happens? Yeah, I've said it before. I was raised to be fucking sexist, racist, and xenophobic. That's the culture I come from. And do you know what I mean? It's the whole fucking checking your privilege thing. It's like, don't pretend to yourself that you've managed to escape being xenophobic or classist or racist or sexist. Chances are, if you grew up in that society and you're at the kind of the top of the system, which I am as a fucking a white man who's also straight, like, I have unconscious biases that I was raised with. That doesn't make me a bad person. And yes, I have been abroad and seen a person from a different culture, and all of a sudden I'm confronted in my head with negative, unhelpful stereotypes about that person. But what I try and do as an adult who can educate themselves, I'm first of all honest with myself about these things, and I try and catch them in the moment and challenge them. Okay? When you don't take ownership of, we'll say, racism or xenophobia that you were raised with, when you don't take ownership of these things in yourself and you pretend, oh, I'm not racist, I'm not xenophobic, that's when microaggressions start. That's when, you know, there's this thing with fucking touching black people's hair, right? Where when if a white person can meet a black person, their inherent kind of racist stereotypes that they were raised with comes up in the person. And rather than take ownership of that, their brain goes into defense mechanism mode. They get uncomfortable around the person from the other culture who looks different or whatever, and they act it out as an excessive niceness. And before you know it, that person is saying, oh, I love your hair, it's so curly, can I touch it? And then they're touching the person's hair. That's a microaggression. And it comes about when somebody doesn't acknowledge their privilege, when they don't acknowledge that they've been raised with this type of stuff, and a defense mechanism kicks in and you're being overly nice, and now you're crossing the other person's boundaries because you're not being authentic with yourself. Do you know what I mean? And that's a tough thing to say, but I'm certainly not going to sit here and pretend that it's like, oh yeah, racism, I missed that one, even though I was raised in a fucking culture which is essentially racist or xenophobic or whatever the fuck you have, you know. But blind boy, we're Irish, how could we don't have racism here? Direct provision, it's happening now, the complete and utter dehumanization of asylum seekers and refugees because they're just too different, and it's happening now. So like, there's your fucking racism in Ireland right now. And when I say racism, this is the thing. I don't mean burning fucking crucifixes. I just mean the unconscious cultural idea of people who look different to you being very different and then othering them in your interaction with them. Saying something or doing something that reminds that person that they are not the same as you or they are lesser than you. Do you know what I mean? And that's the kind of modern face of racism that we all have to, and xenophobia, that we all have to take ownership of, try and catch it in ourselves and change. I mean, that's all I can say on that. And when I say things as well, like fucking white male privilege or shit like checking your privilege and things like that, I know that there's a large proportion of listeners right now rolling their fucking eyes. And the reason you're rolling your eyes is because it's uncomfortable, right? It's uncomfortable to think about. We don't like thinking about it. But it's worth thinking about from a mental health perspective for yourself, so you can achieve greater empathy, and so you're not making other people from a different culture or skin colour or whatever the fuck you have, so you're not making them feel uncomfortable. Just take ownership of it. It doesn't necessarily mean you're a bad person. It's ignorance. But as an adult, you have the full choice to take ownership of it. And what I like to do in these situations, because most of the audience listening is Irish, I'll try and put it into an Irish context that you can relate to. Because Irish people will fucking roll their eyes when they hear a black person or an Asian person on the internet talking about racism they experience. Irish people will roll their eyes at it. But then when a British person or a British news organisation dares to call an Irish celebrity British, the same people get up in arms. If we hear a British person express ignorance about the potato famine, to not know what it is, to not understand that we view it as genocide, we get up in arms. So please remind yourself of that anger when a British person speaks about the Irish, and then apply that to someone from another race or culture or whatever. Like, again, the Irish, like, I mean, we have a little bit of a window into this, okay? We certainly did 200 fucking years ago. Now, not really, but we kind of do a small bit. Like, I go over to London a lot, and I worked in the offices of a creative company in London just for a little bit, for about 2 weeks. It was a television thing I was doing. And British people love the Irish, right? They love us. They think we're hilarious, we're funny. They like to do our accents. They think we're gas. They love having us around. Very amicable and nice, okay? And I had this experience in this office that I was working with in, laughing, blah, 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 until it came to actually expressing ideas and wanting them to be taken seriously. Then all of a sudden, you're the mad Paddy. You're the crazy Paddy with his crazy Paddy ideas. That's the microaggression there. You're a source of entertainment, but when it comes to actually being taken seriously, British culture and their privilege and the culture they were raised in to believe that Irish are thick, backwards fuckers, they've been raised with that. They're not aware of it, and they express that then unconsciously as being incredibly nice to you and then not really taking you that seriously when you want to be taken seriously. That's a microaggression. I remember being outside a pub and just chatting with a British lad who I'd just met. And you know me from this fucking podcast. I'm interested in art, science, culture, the whole fucking shebang, right? So whatever chat I was going on to this fella, I'd obviously gotten into a hot take rant about something, probably something to do with philosophy or art, something that would be categorised as intellectual, okay? So I'm just there as a human being speaking to another human being who happens to be British, just speaking to him about probably something I saw in the British Museum that day. And me having gone on this rant, and I could see him agreeing with me, and he's talking away, and then like a minute later, out of nowhere, he comes out with this comment that's unrelated about, my friend says the Irish are really stupid. And I felt, that felt terrible to me. I was like, what? So basically, this British man had heard me speak with authority about a subject that he considered to be intellectual. Then, for him, his prejudice came up unconsciously, going, oh, this thick Irishman is saying something smart. That doesn't make sense to me. I thought the Irish were thick. He felt uncomfortable because he understands that that's rude. He pushed it down. He didn't acknowledge it. He pushed it down. And then it creeped back up unconsciously as this Freudian slip about the Irish not being smart. That's a microaggression. He's not a bad person. He was just simply unconsciously confronted with his prejudice, didn't know how to deal with it, didn't take ownership, and it expressed itself as a comment that made me feel very small and made me feel othered. And in that moment, I wasn't a human being being passionate about that thing that I love, about art or whatever it was. I wasn't a human being then. I was, oh fuck, I'm a useless fucking thick paddy, and we've done nothing but build these people's roads. Do you know what I mean? So if, as an Irish person, you're listening to that and you're going, fuck it, you're making sense. Yeah, I can relate to that. If you can relate to that, please hear out, either it be a fucking woman or a black person or a traveller or whoever the fuck, hear that person out and believe their experience. If you can relate to my experience there about how the Brits think that we're stupid, bomb-planting, potato-eating, thick fucking mix. Do you know? And keep an eye on the, when you cringe, when you hear somebody talk about privilege or some shit like that. See, that shit's tough to fucking talk about. That's tough to fucking talk about, because then I'm scared myself then of saying the wrong thing. Do you know? Because I don't know what it's like to be a different fucking culture. I don't know. But I answer quite, I look through the fucking, the Patreon or Twitter where he asked the fucking questions, and I answer the question that I see. So again, if you don't like any of the answers, give me a fucking DM. Change my mind if I got something wrong. And I'm not conflating the contemporary Irish experience with microaggressions from the British with, we'll say, black people. Do you know? Microaggressions, prejudice in America and a culture of prejudice towards black people, that microaggression finds its way into a policeman, whereby the culture has criminalized black people based on the color of their skin, and that then that policeman pulls the trigger and the black person is dead. And that's why that shit's really important. Do you know? And I'm not trying to conflate those two experiences. I'm just trying to offer an avenue of empathy for an Irish person, because the Brits think we're thick. It's the bottom level of the scale. But you go up to the top and people are getting shot because of opinions about how they are. There's a black man, he's a criminal. Bang. That's the reality. I'll finish up on that now, because that's, Jesus, what are we, 70 minutes into the podcast, because I had to answer those two incredibly difficult questions that will get me into trouble probably. Have a lovely week. Enjoy the summer. You know, the same thing I say every week. Enjoy the summer. Increase your empathy. Make connections with the earth. Look for otters or crayfish. If anyone sees a crayfish, let me know. If you're looking at any still water, I'm obsessed with finding a crayfish in the wild in Ireland. They're freshwater clawless lobsters. I don't think they're native to Ireland, but they do exist. And I will spend a long time looking into streams to try and see one. I've never seen one. I have once in my life seen an Irish lizard. There is a native Irish lizard. They're brown. They're very good at hiding. And once, about 3 years ago, on a boiling hot day in Limerick, I looked down at my feet and there was a little Irish lizard basking in the sun. But I want to see a crayfish. Go in peace, you absolute cunts.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.